Hey, if you're listening to this, I will assume you're at least interested in money, understanding the economy, and finances as well. And some of us now want to get the next generation interested as well. So check out Million Bazillion, Marketplace's award-winning kids podcast that breaks down money to help dollars make more sense. Tune into Million Bazillion wherever you find your favorite podcasts. A whole new season is out now. Million Bazillion is presented in partnership with Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Greenlight helps kids and teens learn to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest. Get 1 month free and an extra $10 when you sign up for a Greenlight account at greenlight.com/million. A Nobel Prize for the study of poverty and a car that costs $75,000 all in the same radio program from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Monday, the 12th day of October. Good as always to have you with us, everybody. Today's top story comes to us by way of Stockholm, Sweden, via Edinburgh, Scotland, and finally Princeton, New Jersey, where a 69-year-old man named Angus Deaton got a phone call this morning telling him he had won the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economics. The Scottish-born Deaton has been on the faculty at Princeton for 33 years, where he spent much of his time trying to improve the way we measure some pretty important things in the dismal science, things like who counts as poor and what the value of a dollar is in, say, India versus Manhattan. Those are, on the face of it, relatively simple questions, but Deaton made his reputation in part by showing just how hard they are to answer. Marketplace's Noel King gets us going.
Earlier this month, the World Bank made a big announcement. This year, the rate of people living in extreme poverty worldwide will likely fall below 10% of the population, the first time in history. Angus Deaton had something to say about that in a press conference celebrating his Nobel Prize win at Princeton today.
And that's wonderful, but there's still 700 million people who are poor.
Much of Deaton's work has focused on the lives of people in developing countries like India. Charles Kenny, a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development, says there's a central question at the heart of Deaton's work.
Why are some people in the world still living lives that are as poor as anybody through history, while many of us enjoy a lifestyle and a quality of life that's just unheard of? And what can we do about that?
In order to find policy solutions, first you have to know who is poor. Deaton's research has illustrated how difficult that is to determine.
He is really like the mentor of like all the development economists.
William Easterly, a professor of economics at NYU, says Deaton has made advancements in measuring who is poor by starting with the acknowledgement that money buys different things in different countries.
Is a dollar in Ghana the same as a dollar in the U.S.? Of course not. He corrects for that and then comes up with these very careful measurements of global poverty.
Deaton is also known for insisting on the use of household surveys and for looking at what individual families consume in relation to what they earn. Other economists look primarily at the data of large groups of people. But over time, the Nobel Committee said Deaton's microdata has changed how we understand the macroeconomy. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
There are times in business and economics when what you think is the story really isn't the story. The headline in tech today is the $67 billion deal that has Dell, the computer company, buying the data storage company EMC. Rumors were abounding last week. Dell is a pretty good-sized company, as you know, but it doesn't have that kind of money just sitting around. So it's going to borrow, which is fine because interest rates are low and money is cheap. But the Fed, as you may have heard, is this close to an interest rate hike. So Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports now from New York on what money that is not so cheap anymore might mean, both for the deals that big corporations make and for smaller deals that might involve you.
When we're talking about multi-billion dollar deals, slight changes in interest rates can add up to a lot of money. So to what extent do they drive whether big deals like this get done?
The short answer is not in the least.
Dartmouth business professor Anant Sundaram says the data just don't show borrowing cost as a big driver.
Interest rates play a very small, a barely perceptible role in affecting mergers and acquisitions, or even more broadly, corporate investment decisions.
Low rates are good and all, but Dell's buying EMC now because it believes the companies will be worth more together, period. Donna Hitcherich is a Columbia Business School professor and former investment banker.
Good deal is a good deal. If you think it's a good deal, you should buy it. Cheap money just gives you a bigger margin for error.
There will be big deals before and after the Fed does its thing. Smart companies don't let short-term moves pressure them into long-term choices. It's basically like buying a house. Let's say you're in the market right now. You should decide whether to buy based on what's right for your family and budget, not just whether mortgage rates are tempting. Don't be swayed by what a bunch of central bankers might or might not do.
The danger is getting into something that you're not ready for, or it's not exactly what you're looking for.
Trulia chief economist Selma Hepp says, think long term.
Because it's a lifetime investment, it should not be a decision that should be rushed.
No matter how cheap the money, whether you're buying a house or acquiring a company, don't do it unless you are pretty sure you want it. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
We all know there is lots and lots of money in American politics right now. It's practically sloshing around out there, sloshing around. According to the New York Times, this weekend, of the $176 million given so far in the first stages of the 2016 presidential campaign, almost half of it has come from just 158 families, families that skew Republican. There are, for some context, about 120 million households in the U.S. overall. Nicholas Confessori is a national correspondent at the New York Times. He covers money and politics for the paper, and he shared the byline on the story. Nick, welcome to the program.
It's good to be here, Kai.
Who are these families, the 158 or so of them?
So they have a few things in common, Kai. They are almost all white, wealthy, and male. They come from two industries predominantly, finance and energy. But what struck me in the reporting was that these people are not from Exxon or Goldman Sachs. It's mostly men who struck out from those larger companies and became independent producers of oil, some wildcatters and frackers, people who set up hedge funds and venture capital firms, people who go it alone in business as well as in campaigns.
And you say in the piece that so far in the 2016 campaign, they appear to be leaning, they are leaning overwhelmingly toward the Republican side of the field.
What we're seeing is that almost all of the money so far flowing in from these families is flowing to Republicans. That's partly a consequence of the fact that the Republicans have a more competitive primary, and all of the candidates on that side have these big super PACs. But I think it also reflects a little bit about the way the politics of the super wealthy are flowing. What's interesting to me, though, Kai, is how little money, in some sense, there is.
Yeah.
There is an extraordinary amount of wealth in this country in many different industries. What strikes me about our list is who is not there. There is almost no tech money there, for example. So tech, Silicon Valley, is an industry that has minted billionaires and multimillionaires. You can make $1 billion in Silicon Valley without ever having an inspector come onto your oil patch. It's just a very different environment. I think it shapes their view of the role of government, and it shapes their activism in the campaign.
Two words here, Nick, that bear intensely on this entire discussion, Citizens United, the Supreme Court's case from 5 years ago about money in politics.
That's right. Almost all of this money is flowing through channels that were legalized by Citizens United. Almost all of it is going into super PACs. And Citizens United essentially allowed wealthy people, corporations, and labor unions to make unlimited contributions to these super PACs with the promise that they be independent from the candidates. Essentially what it means is that a billionaire who might once have been barred from giving more than $2,000 or so dollars to a candidate can now give several million or 10 million or a billion if they want through the super PAC, which then supports the candidate. So this new world we're talking about is not possible really before 2010.
If I remember the article right, you didn't have a whole lot of luck, not terribly surprisingly, getting these people to talk to you, people from these 158 families. I am curious, though, as to their perception of their return on investment, you know?
Yeah, I think it is very hard to find a wealthy person who made a contribution who will say that they did it to protect their own wealth or to guard their own self-interest. You know, liberals and conservatives alike have ideologies of why they give, and the conservative wealthy people say that they give to preserve the system that allowed people to become successful like them, and they want others to follow in their footsteps. They believe that government and government spending threatens that system of wealth creation for everybody. But there are liberal people, and in some cases, they're business partners, right? So liberal and conservative people who work together at the same firms have radically different views about this. On the left, they say that they give despite their economic self-interest, that they think the country is better off if they pay more taxes.
Nick Confessori is covering money and politics in the 2016 cycle. His piece, it's online now, is about the families funding the 2016 presidential election. Nick, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai.
Another day, another meh on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. There are some cities, L.A., New York, Chicago, and Baltimore, that tend to get a lot of the best parts on television. It's rare indeed that a smaller city gets a starring role, and when it does, it often winds up playing some other town. So enter now West Covina, California, a middle-class suburb about 20 or so miles east of downtown L.A., population 110,000. It steps into the spotlight tonight as the co-star of a new show on the CW called Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. And if the show is a hit, it could put West Covina on the map, so to speak. Marketplace's Adrian Hill took a ride out the 10 freeway to find out how the city got the part.
Here's the setup. Depressed professional runs into her childhood crush on the streets of New York.
Dude, we should hang out.
Actually, I'm moving.
Moving.
West Covina, California, 91791.
It's near the beach, right?
Yeah, only 2 hours, but 4 in traffic.
True to the crazy and crazy ex-girlfriend, she follows him there.
West Covina.
West Covina.
It's a classic big city fish out of water story. But why West Covina? Why not Glendora or just regular Covina or any other middle-income, slightly dated suburb near Los Angeles? There's a Yelp page called Best Fun Things to Do in West Covina, and the first two things on the list aren't in West Covina. I head over to Colony at the Lakes, named for an entertainment center, not a body of water, where hundreds of new apartments are being built.
It's not in downtown Los Angeles, but this is really, you know, kind of the downtown Los Angeles of West Covina.
That's leasing consultant Cameron Jones. The downtown Los Angeles of West Covina is walking distance to a mall, a multiplex, the Shoehorn and Buster Brown Museum, open by appointment. Aline Brosh McKenna is co-creator and executive producer of Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I call her up to get a more definitive answer to the question.
What brings you to our lovely West Covina?
It struck us as the perfect place to kind of depict sort of what a contemporary American suburb is like.
It's diverse. It's got big box stores, trees, a beloved shopping mall, and pretzels. Lots of pretzels.
When we went to the mall, there was a pretzel store on one end of the mall, and then we got to the other end of the mall, there was another pretzel store, just in case you got peckish for a pretzel in between the one end of the mall and the other end of the mall. And so we love that. And there's actually yet another pretzel store in the mall.
And there's something else that drew the show to West Covina.
I love the sound of it.
West Covina, California.
It was a great word for Rachel to sing and build the song around. So obviously by now it's quite beloved to us. And I think I've lost all objectivity about how it sounds to others.
It does roll off the tongue quite easily, doesn't it?
That's West Covina Mayor Pro Tem James Toma, with West Covina Mayor Frederick Sykes giggling in the background.
What can I say? It's a very good name. People do like to say it when they ask where you're from, West Covina. Oh, like, people often repeat it back to me.
Sykes is just happy the show's here, whatever the reason.
It's absolutely fantastic. It's a gift.
The city makes a few thousand dollars in shooting fees per episode, but Sykes is dreaming big.
TV itself is such a draw for us as primates. So with that alone, people think that, hey, where are they filming at? Well, they're filming in West Covina. And so they may go there just to shop and hang out and look and see what's going on in the city and to see if the cameras are rolling.
As for how the people in West Covina feel about being a bit of a punchline...
You seen this resume? Harvard, Yale, special skills, Mandarin. What the hell is she doing here?
But really, now, what isn't a butt of a joke? Everything everywhere is a butt of a joke for something, you know?
That's Joey Mancuso. He owns Anna's Pizza. His family's been in West Covina for decades. There was a time, he says...
When you told people West Covina, nothing good really came after it.
But that's changing. Graffiti's been painted over. Stores are moving into empty spaces.
And now it's coming up, and it's very cool to be a part of the positive things that are happening in this town.
And West Covina has earned itself a starring role.
My new life is about to start.
In West Covina, I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
coming up.
I suppose I'd rather be a low profitability company that's larger than a small company that has higher percentage profitability.
Tesla CEO Elon Musk on profits and failure and the future. But first, let's do the numbers. Not a whole lot of action on this Columbus Day holiday. The Dow Industrials added 0.25%, 47 points, 17,131. The NASDAQ up 0.1%, 8 points, 48.38. The S&P 500 took home 0.1%, 1.2017. Banks were closed today, but traders were placing their bets on upcoming bank earnings. JP Morgan Chase, which reports tomorrow, off 0.3%. We told you about the Dell EMC deal. EMC shares up 1.75% on that news. Dell is a privately held company. Twitter took a nearly 7% hit today on rumors that big layoffs are coming. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's been a good long while since I've had car lust, but I had some the other day, and exactly how much of it kind of surprised me. The people at Tesla let me use their baseline Model S. It's technically called the 70D, which, full disclosure, I would totally think about buying if the sticker price wasn't $75,000 and I didn't have kids to put through college. But it does, and I do, so it was just fun to drive around for a couple of days before I sat down with Tesla CEO Elon Musk, which I did last week at the giant factory up in Fremont, California, near San Francisco, the production center for all those whiz-bang electric cars, including the Model S, and the new one that Musk rolled out at the end of last month, the Model X, the one with the funny doors. It is a giant place, that factory. People riding bikes to get around. Giant red robot arms welding and sparking all over the place. And the robot arms come to life. Oh, man.
Wow.
A metal stamping machine the size of a four-story building.
It is kind of an assembly line wonderland in here.
It is straight up a heavy industrial operation for which expectations are high. So on today's installment of Conversations from the Corner Office, the guy in charge.
We're expecting you. Won't you have a seat?
Ready to go to work?
Elon Musk runs not only Tesla, but also, as you may know, the space exploration company SpaceX. Anyway, we sat down in a conference room just off the Tesla factory floor, where they make about 1,000 cars a week, by the way. A factory that at the beginning, Musk wasn't at all sure would happen.
5 years ago, I would have probably thought that we would have been here. But if you asked me at the beginning of Tesla, would I have thought that we'd be here, I would have said no. I thought we'd most likely not succeed. I thought we'd most likely die.
I'm pausing here just because that's an interesting thing for a guy running a big company like this to say.
Well, of course. I mean, the track record for car company startups is extremely poor. In fact, the only car companies in the U.S. that have not gone bankrupt are currently Ford and Tesla. Like GM and Chrysler went bankrupt.
Yeah, no, I was there. I remember that.
Yeah.
I had a conversation with Alan Mulally, the guy who used to run Ford. I was talking to him 6 or 7 years ago, and I said, you know, what would you rather do? Would you rather be, and this was when the car industry was starting to slow down, I said, would you rather be profitable, or would you rather be the biggest car company in the world? And he said, profitable in a heartbeat. We'll sell off and we will downsize. The analogous question to you is, would you rather build an electric car that is going to change society, or would you rather build market share and be one of the big three automakers?
Well, like I said, we are trying to change the nature of transportation. So definitely scale matters, because more electric cars means more change in the way we transport people. I think in the case of Tesla, I would hopefully this is a false dichotomy, but. Mm-hmm. But I suppose I'd rather be a low profitability company that's larger than a small company that has higher percentage profitability. But I, like I said, I think that's probably a false dichotomy. I think ultimately it can be a big company that is profitable, although obviously we're not profitable today.
So what is it about entrepreneurialism for you that gets you? Because clearly that's what's going on here, right?
Yeah, I mean, I do think that creating a company to produce a product or service that people love that's very rewarding, no question. You know, what I'm trying to do is, I mean, at a broader philosophical level, is I'm trying to minimize existential risk in the future. That's what I'm trying to do. Trying to make the future good. Try to be as helpful as possible in that direction. Things have worked out a lot better than I expected. I sort of really expected things to not work out, actually. So,
talk to me for a minute about failure, about the value that you put on it, and how much of it you tolerate in this company.
Well, I think like most people, I don't like failure. But I mean, if you don't allow for some amount of failure, then it's very difficult to innovate. So, I mean, I do expect that we push hard to innovate, and therefore some amount of failure must be acceptable. Otherwise, you won't be able to, you know, explore new territory.
So, all right, so let me ask you a more specific question. So the Falcon Wing doors on the Model X, how many iterations, how many failures did you have in what is really a sort of a breakthrough kind of thing?
Yeah, quite a few failures, actually. We tried several iterations on the door, and I'll tell you what we're trying to achieve. Why did we make the door at all? What we're trying to achieve is, how do you directly access to the third row while still having child seats in the second row?
Right, it's all over.
You can't get to the third row. And right. I experienced this personally when I got
to... You and me both, pal.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I think like a lot of parents have experienced this. And so then you're like, wow, I've got this big SUV, but I can't use a large portion of it. So in order to do that, you have to have a big opening. You can have a sliding door, and then you've got to support the sliding door with three pins.
With and hinges so, and all that stuff. Yeah,
yeah. And then the three pins, you know, that creates sort of like a gash along the side of the, yep. the car, which doesn't look good either. In order to have the car look good, you can't make it slide. So then you've got to open it in some way. But a traditional gullwing door only has one hinge, and so it opens up too far outward and too far up. And so the way that we solved this was by putting a second hinge, and thus calling it a gullwing door,
Falcon
door instead of a gullwing door, because it's got two independently actuating hinges,
right?
And it opens up instead of outward.
Which part of your job do you enjoy more? Getting out there with the engineers and getting your hands dirty? And I know the answer to this question before I ask it. Or sitting in boring management meetings where you have to figure out the HR policy for this company. You default to engineering.
Engineering and design is, you know, actually engineering design is what I actually do spend most of my time on. I mean, right now about maybe 3% of my time is spent on things like, say, interviews and media, yeah. and that kind of thing. I think sometimes people think it's a lot more than that, but it's only, you know, maybe. Even less than 3%, probably, because it's less than a few hours per week.
This is so funny. I can see you actually doing the calculations now. I mean, you're more comfortable in that realm of quantified stuff.
I like engineering. I also like design aesthetics. Yeah. Really gets me fired up when somebody buys the car and they love it.
Yeah.
You know?
It's been a big couple of weeks for you with the rollout of the Model X and the presentation. I wonder if you worry about this company and yourself being overexposed.
We are overexposed from time to time. That's not the reason I'm going. I'm going to be reducing my media activity to more like 1% instead of maybe 3 or 4%. But mostly because I need more time to focus on actually building the products.
Well, so I can't, you know, talking about you and having more time, I can't be the first one who's pointed out to you, look, Elon, you have really capable people working for you at SpaceX. You have really capable people working for you at Tesla. You don't have to be running both companies, man. Any thought of that?
Long term, I'm sure I won't be running either company because I'll be, you know, retired or dead or something, you know, so.
Yeah, but you're what, 45? You got a ways to go yet.
Yeah.
So here's a better question. What would it take for you to stop day-to-day management of either one of these companies? And I acknowledge that, you know, Tesla's publicly traded and you're talking to investors and all that stuff. And I get that. But, yeah, as he looks up at me with a wry smile. But
I expect to be with SpaceX and Tesla for as long into the future as I can imagine.
Last thing. You keep saying Tesla. The rest of us keep saying Tesla. Who's right?
Yeah, I think you're both right.
Oh. Elon Musk, thanks very much for your time.
All right.
You can see those robotic arms in action and the rest of the Tesla factory as well, and our entire interview with Elon Musk on our Corner Office podcast, including maybe his biggest gamble, building the world's biggest battery factory out in Nevada. It's all at marketplace.org or, of course, wherever you get your podcasts. Final note on the way out today, what happens when the Nobel Committee calls, as related by brand new laureate Angus Deaton at his press conference today. Here you go. Give a listen.
They were very keen to make sure that I did not think it was a prank. And I don't know whether this is common. I've never had a prank phone call telling me anything. And of course, as soon as they said that, I thought, oh my God, maybe it is a prank. It's just what they would say.
Just like an economist. He got 8 million Swedish krona for the prize, by the way. That's about 978,000 American dollars. Hey, look at the time. Got to go. The Dow Industrial's up 0.25% today, about 47 points. The NASDAQ up 0.1%. That is 8 points. The S&P 500 took home 0.1%. 1 point there. Our daily production team includes Tommy Andres, Bridget Bodner, Mukta Mohan, and Daisy Palacios. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.